Well, thank you for inviting me. It's very good to be back. It's been a couple of years since last time I was here. And as Freddy was saying, well, you guys, I think, now have seen this CHY formulas in the scattering equations and seen the power of them to represent scattering amplitudes and how they have some resemblance to string theory formulas. And so it's a natural, very natural question really to ask, where do they come from? And my job today is to give you a glimpse and introduce this theory that calculates these amplitudes from first principles. There's some machinery involved, which is mostly CFT and string theory, BRC quantization. But I think you guys have seen that or parts of it. So I won't go too much into calculational details. You can ask me later, or you can look at the references. But I'll try to give you all the necessary details, and so you have the calculational tools to go and redo the calculations we've done in these basic papers, and then go into the literature. But if you have any questions or anything at all, or if I start writing about something that you guys haven't seen, please stop me and ask, and I'll explain in more detail. All right? So I guess then. So this is the introduction as it's to ambitwistor strings. And I'll explain what are ambitwistors and why they are string theories by the end of this. Strings one, or as is genus zero for now. Because then later on the week, maybe not tomorrow, later on, you're going to see the generalization of this to higher. Does this work? To higher genus. Good. I have to say, this is the first time I'm giving a lecture in this room, so I have to get used to this. So. There's actually, if you go back in the literature, there is a long story of using twister and ambitwister spaces to calculate amplitudes. These spaces, twister space and ambitwister spaces, they are related to ambitwisters. They are related to basically spaces of no geodesics on Minkowski spacetime. So if you have Minkowski spacetime, and you look at a point and you look at the light cone, on this point, basically, in a very rough way, twister space is a space of lines, of these null lines. Sorry. If you look at a null line here in Minkowski space, this is related to points in twister space. I'm just twister space. So. People have tried for many years to use, because it's a known, there's this known local relation between Minkowski space and twister space. But because we're not going to go into much details on twister space, I won't talk very much about it. But it's just from a historical perspective, this is the one that was most successful used before, and mostly because of work done by Witten, Nathan Berkowitz, and was based on some work by Nair even beforehand on this, you might have heard, on the twister strings. So the twister strings were a string theories, which means they were theories of maps from some worksheet. And then you can, here, if you want something concrete, you can think about a sphere, but it can be higher genus, into this kind of twister spaces. And what was interesting about, let me just write down some references here. So 0312, these are archive references. Right, and what was interesting on this is that when you look at correlation functions or look at scattering amplitudes given by this kind of string theories, you find formulas, which you probably seen last week, and very close to what you seen last week, which are called the SRSVW formulas. And those are yes, and those have a very interesting form. They are written as, so this doesn't move.
Yeah, the top one doesn't work. So
the top one doesn't.
That is called front. So that one doesn't work.
Okay.
And last week we called them the Witten RSV formulas.
Ah, Witten RSV formulas.
That's okay.
Witten.
Shorter.
Yes, that you there is a permutation of the W to the front. Yes. So those formulas, then they write in scattering amplitude. So as you've seen then last week. A scattering amplitude, then is written in terms of some integral over some space. There's some integrand, and there's a universal piece, which are some kind of equations. And I put an R here because these are now called refined scattering equations. And there, in four dimension, there's actually several forms of them, but they're all dealing with lambdas and lambda tildes as functions of z, where these are polynomials of degree d and d tilde, right? And what is important about this, what's later recognized, is that requiring them to be zero is in a sense the same thing as requiring that this true, that you can write some momenta field P of Z as lambda, lambda tilde of a dot of Z. And this is as in four dimensions, D is equals four, you can do that. And you do that when you're talking about massless particles because this solves this mass shell equation for all Z's on Rohr sheet, right? So this scattering equations is really a statement about getting this momenta, this field squared equals to zero to every point on the Rohr sheet, right? So that was for a long time. This was a four-dimensional statement until Song and Freddy and Ellis. Came up with a generalization of them to general dimensions, right? So there's a generalization, which you learn about Friday, I think. To any dimension, which is given by the Cacciaso He U1 formulas and the scattering equations. Right. So, and now I'm going to write basically the same thing I wrote down on the other blackboard. There is some integral over some manifold. There is an integrand, but now I have a different set of equations. But you can see that I mean those kind of they have a very similar structure. Right. This formula and this formula here. Well, now this is scattering equations. You learned last week, so just to remind ourselves, they are given by ki dot kj over zi minus zj. And what do they have to do with p square? Is that if I define a field p, which is basically just summing over all the momenta at each point z, and I know for I'm only looking at massless particles, so I know that this is true for all i's. Then p squared of z is just has only simple poles on the location of those momenta on these punctures j. So only simple poles. And then, and And moreover, if you look at how it transforms under coordinate transformations, this is a quadratic differential. Differential on sigma, so you should really be thinking that there is a dz squared really coming in with this, because it's really a quadratic differential on the surface. Then you can look at residues of this guy at each point zi, and this is exactly the scattering equations. You look at these residues, because it's only simple poles, they are canonical. And you get this, right? So this is I. And then if I set n minus 3 of this to 0, then that's enough to set this whole thing to 0. Right. So why is that? Is that because this is a quadratic differential, and it has only simple poles, and it's just a statement that you cannot write a quadratic differential with only three simple poles. It just vanishes. If you try to write any expression like that and make it SL2 invariant. Right, so the story here and the story there, so this is for general dimensions, and the story for four dimensions are very similar, except there is this started life as a twist or string. So there is a theory behind it that you can use to derive these formulas. Well, here we started with the formulas. And in principle, we don't know if there is any kind of theory that gives this formula. So what we want to do is we want now to go the other way around, stare at these formulas, stare at that condition, and see if we can come up with something that some kind of theory that lives on a Riemann surface, because all those fields live on a Riemann surface, that gives me that is the generalization of this twister string. And that's what I'm going to do on the rest of this lecture. So any questions before I start? This, I think, is just review, right? So what are the main points that we paying attention? So what is the important point here? The important point here is that I have a field which is P of Z, and this is a meromorphic one form on sigma. In this lecture, I'm going to take sigma to be maybe I should put an N. So N, so it's an N-punctured Riemann sphere, which is, just means that it's a sphere with a prescribed complex structure, because I'm calling it meromorphic. And this form, so this is a one form, and it has at most simple poles on this. So this is the kind of surface we're dealing here. Later on the week, you're gonna see how to deal with higher genus surfaces. And so we have this field, and we have a constraint that we must impose in some way, which is P squared being 0. So we need a theory. An action, if you want, that imposes these conditions. So what I'm going to talk about is going to be what is called now the bosonic commutator string, at least at the beginning, because it is the one that has all of the ingredients to generate. It's the simplest one. It has all the ingredients to generate this kind of integral and the scattering equations. As you've seen, that this is a generic, you can write scattering amplitudes for massless particles in a generic way. In this way, you just change the integrand to get different amplitudes. And that integrand is going to be generated by different slightly modifications on this Bayes theory that I'm going to be talking about. And I'm going to talk about very explicitly with kind of some of these generalizations that you can do to get different theories later on. Now, so I should say that This work, this original work on the Ambitusser string, was first done by Mason and Skinner a few years ago. Well, now quite a few years ago. 5, 6, 4. And what I'm going to talk about is going to be related, is going to be mostly this work plus some on a follow-up paper which is me, David Skinner, and Tim Adamo. 12, 3, 8, 8, because this has some loops, fermions, and it talks about the moduli in more detail, and especially how the scattering equations appear. So most of this talk is going to be these two papers. Another interesting paper to look that talks a lot about the geometry, and I found very interesting paper by Kantaro Omori, which if you're not happy with my presentation, you can look at his presentation, which is closer to how string theory, a more modern string theory, perturbative methods in string theory. And you can also look at the first few chapters of my thesis. So just make sure. And Yvonne's thesis. So those two theses, both of them have, on the beginning, introduction to Ambitusser strings, and they are a bit more streamlined than the literature, if it is a bit too technical. So those are references, and so let's start. What do we want? I should say there's a lot more literature, and I'm going to give some more references at the end to more to some work that has been done to generalize the story, and you're going to see some of this work on the other lectures this week. And you can also, I'm here for the whole week, so if you have any questions, please come and ask me or send me an email. Right, so we have that holomorphic, well, that meromorphic one-form with simple poles on our puncture Riemann surface. We have some constraint, p squared equals zero. So we're going to do the simplest thing. It's going to look for a theory of maps from some Riemann surface, n puncture Riemann surface, to M. And simplest case, M is just going to be Minkowski with metric. Flat metric eta mu nu. So if I get coordinates x on Minkowski space, then these maps are just going to be maps from the worksheet, so given by x to some function, sorry, so z to some function x of z. And, well, simplest thing I can write. No, this one is an action on over where I have a field x, coordinates, sorry, the field p, coordinates mu, d bar x mu, minus a half e p mu p nu eta mu nu. So this, if you're familiar with string theory, this action doesn't really look like a string theory, and there's a few differences. First is that this is a first-order action. So because this is a first-order differential operator, this operator is really just a shorthand for dz bar, this is d bar. but and why do I want this? Is because if I try to write a an action which has a second order differential operator like the string, I'm not going to get something holomorphic. I want something holomorphic. So if I want something holomorphic, I need a chiral theory. So this is a chiral 2D theory. Exactly because you only have a D bar for the kinetic term and not a D. Right. Moreover, I have here a Lagrange multiplier. That if I vary the action with respect to it, it just gives me p squared is zero. So it's just enforcing the constraint that we want, this p squared with respect to the flat metric, and we'll leave at that for now. But I know I don't want I wanted to have I want to end up with this being a string theory. So the next step is that I'm going to turn this into a CFT, and the way to turn into a CFT is just I'm going to give proper conformal weights to this action such that it is conformally invariant on the word sheet. So how do I do that? Well, we know that this has holomorphic weights, so I'm going to write down this weight of the field. So in order for that kinetic term to to be conformally invariant, I need to have something that has holomorphic weight 1. And that's fine, because I want that field P to be a holomorphic one form. So P, then, is just a section N of the canonical. So this is just notation for is a section of the Zs. So it's a section of the canonical bundle. Which just means is a holomorphic one form. So being a holomorphic one form now, this term here has weight, holomorphic weight 1, anti-holomorphic weight 1, so it's conformally invariant. Now, here I have 2p's, so this has holomorphic weight 2, and I needed to have holomorphic weight 1 and anti-holomorphic weight 1. So that fixes what E is. So E then has anti-holomorphic weight 1. The section on is a field on the worksheet and has values on the tangent bundle, holomorphic tangent bundle. So you can just think these are things which are DDZs, right? So this, if you know some geometry, this is the same weight as Beltrami differential. And yes, it comes into play later on when you're going to really study the geometry of this. But so far is a Lagrange multiplier, right? So with this, and also I have another field X. X has no conformal weight, so it's just a global section on N. So with this conformal weights, then the claim is that the action S is a CFT, the two-dimensional CFT. Any questions? Yes.
Okay, I'm not sure whether everybody in this room is familiar with the buzzwords canonical bundle and Beltrami differential. Which details of that do we need in the following?
So the details is that when I say if I say canonical bundle, means DZ. It just means that if I say something is a section of canonical bundle, it's something that is a one form. The section of K squared, something that is a quadratic differential. So you can these are fields on the worksheet which have a DZ hanging on them. Let's say that. And the tangent bundle, which is dual to this, which is dual to the function of the DZ, is something that goes with a DZ bar. It just tells you how these fields transform, which also tells what is their conformal weight on for these fields. You had CFT, right? Yes. So another way of saying is that if I look at the conformal weights of P, this has conformal weight 1, 0. This has conformal weights 1 minus 1, and this has conformal weights 0, 0, right? And with that, then this action is a CFT, right? Moreover, so this action is a CFT. Now, because I have that constraint, I have gauge transformations which are generated by that constraint. So P squared equals 0 generates gauge transformations. Which, if you want to look at the classical level, you just pick the Poisson bracket with this, with the fields. But it turns out that it is just a local invariance given by dx mu is equal to alpha p mu, dp mu is equal to 0. And then dE is our gauge field. It transforms by a gauge transformation alpha. So in particular, this, because p squared is 0, then this is a translation along no geodesics, or no lines, no directions. So which means that this action in space-time actually doesn't want to live on the space of axis. And p's, you want to live in the space of x's and p's, modulo this gauge transformation, right? So what I have here then is I have a space of p and x's, modulo this gauge transformation. So what is the space? The space here is the cotangent bundle to M. So it's just a space of the one forms, you take the one forms and also the space of x on M. And then you're quotient by this p squared equals 0 here. So this is a, if you're familiar with this, this quotient by gauge transformation is called a symplectic quotient. If you're not familiar with this, it's not going to be important for later on, but it's important for the interpretation of this as an ambitwister string. As living on ambitwister space. So symplectic quotient. And this space here, it's what is called an ambitwister space. So this is ambitwister space. So ambitwister space is nothing more than the space of no geodesics on spacetime. So this presentation is for flat space and is a very simple presentation for flat space. But this kind of space certainly exists for generic Riemannian manifolds. And this is really the reason why this is called an ambitwister string, is because just from this basic action, you can interpret the space of fields where the target space, the space where this field takes values, is really not p and x, but it's p and x mod this constraint that we're imposing. So that's where the name ambitwister string comes from. Later on, there's going to be another relationship with ambitwister space at the level of vertex operators, and I'll come back to, which makes this relation even stronger. But I don't want to get into too much details. There's a lot of literature on ambitwister space. No. Any questions? Oh, I am running late. Okay, so we have that action, but that's just a CFT so far. What we want is a string theory, and in order to get a string theory, what you do, you need to gauge the Wurmschmidt gravity, which means you need to gauge the stress energy tensor, which for us works very well because there's an extra There is an extra gauge symmetry. So another gauge symmetry. Which is given by dx mu is just coordinate transformations for this p mu v mu e v d minus v. This v is just a vector on my Riemann surface. So, and this, of course, the constraint that generates this is a stress energy tensor. And for us, that's going to be this constraint. This is just the holomorphic derivative. This is just d, dz, right? So if I look at that action, that CFT, and I not only gauge p, I'm already gauging p squared, but I also gauge t. So by gauging t, by setting it to zero, then I hope to get a string theory. Right? So what you can think about is that you can think about this action as partially gauge fixed. So just like in string theory, S is partially gauge fixed to conformal gauge. Just like in string theory, where conformal gauge in string theory, so in string theory, conformal gauge gives you an action, which is dx dot d bar x. So you need to take this action plus the constraints t equals 0 and t bar equals 0. So let me put this up. So you already see the difference now. So this is string theory in conformal gauge. You have a free action. We have a free action. But string theory gauges these two constraints, which is stress energy, holomorphic and anti-holomorphic stress energy tensor. The amplitude string, we're going to have a free action. We are gauging p squared, and we're gauging the holomorphic coordinate invariants to get a chiral with string theory. Right? So how do we do this gauge fixing? Then, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about BRST quantization, which is the standard way. We can do other quantizations. You can do light cone or old covariant quantizations. But because this is a chiral theory, all the computations are much simpler and much more easier to do if in this BRST. But if you're not familiar with BRST, you can stop me at some point. So what we're going to do is that we have two constraints, t p dot dx, and we have h, which is minus p squared over 2. We want to gauge them. So what we do, we have to add bosons. Add ghosts. We add ghosts. So there's a ghost action. 2 pi e d bar c plus e tilde bar c tilde. Each one of these ghosts corresponds to one of the constraints. This b has conformal weight, is equal to the conformal weights of b tilde, and is 2, 0. So it's a quadratic differential on the worksheet. C has the same conformal weights as c tilde, which is minus 1, 0. So it's a vector, holomorphic vector on the worksheet. But these are fermionic, because they're fermions, because they are ghosts for the bosonic constraints. right? So we define now a BRST operator which is given by a charge Q. The charge is integral over some cycle on the worksheet. That doesn't really depend on which cycle you pick. So you pick the C ghost times the stress energy tensor, just like the string theory, plus a C tilde times my constraint H, which is a new constraint. And this is my BRST operator, right? So the important properties of BRST operator is that Q on B is equal to T, Q of the energy ghost B tilde is equal to H, and moreover, you have consistency conditions that are given by Q, which is that we need, as you know, Q generates a cohomology, so we need Q squared equals zero, right? And if you do the calculation using the Poisson brackets, you're gonna see that Q squared equals zero doesn't give you any constraints, so this theory is classically well defined as it stands. But as you might expect, there are anomalies when you do the quantum theory. So fine classically. But there are anomalies. So how do I calculate these anomalies? Well, since I have a CFT and I have a free CFT, I can do everything by OPEs, right? So I have a free CFT, so which means I can calculate things by doing operator product expansions and just from the operator product expansions of the free fields. So what are they is that because it's a free action on P and Z, then just gives, the OPE is just given by 1 over Z minus W. And the same thing for the ghost system. So they are very simple. So if you use them to calculate now, if you use this as a quantization, see, this is just radial quantization, usual thing you do on a CFT, then you find that Q squared is equal to zero only if D is equal to 26. So there is a critical dimension. And that critical dimension is equal to the string theory, to the bosonic string theory. And it's equal to string theory. Even though that theory is really not the same as string theory, it has, by anomaly cancellations, it has the same critical dimension.
Is there a C tilde somewhere in this?
Sorry?
Is there a C tilde here somewhere in this relation or not?
Yeah, sorry. Yes. And all the others are zero. So if you want something to do, you can just take that BRST operator, calculate Q squared with these OPEs, and you're going to find this requirement. Now, since we have BRST operator, it also allows us to look for physical states, right? So if you remember your string theory course, there is a requirement that physical states are in the cohomology of that BRST operator. And so physical states then Q of some physical state is zero, and this physical state is not Q of something else. Right? Now, because we have a CFT, we can use the CF, you can use the state operator correspondence to look to, instead of talking about correspondence. So instead of talking about states on a Hilbert space, we can shrink the states. So usually on a Hilbert space on the string, you're thinking about having some circle at infinity and some other circle at plus infinity, or maybe you have some word sheet that looks something like this. And then at each circle, you're going to have a Hilbert space with some states that have to obey this. By the state operator correspondence, you can map this kind of situation to a situation where you have local operators on the punctures. Local operators, let me call them phi. And then this, because they came from physical states, there is a physical, there's a condition for these operators to be physical. And this is just that Q of V is equal to zero. So these are, and then this is a physical operator. This is a condition for physical state. So this is much simpler to look in the CFT. And so we're going to look for operators that obey that condition. So if we can find all the operators on the CFT that obey this condition, we have the full spectrum of the theory, and we can start to have a guess to what the target space theory is. And you've seen in string theory that that condition of physicality is actually, well, quite strong. It gives you an infinite number of states, right? Because the string theory has, there is a massless level, and then you have an infinite tower of massive states on top of that. But if you want to get few theory amplitudes, we have to see that for the amplitudes of string, this condition is much, much stronger than the string theory, because you only have a finite set of massless states that we want to describe, right? So let's take a look a bit what this will require. So we won't talk about scattering amplitude. So I want V to be proportional to a state that has this dependence on X, has a plane wave dependence on X, right? Remember, this is in some point on the word sheet. And this is just some constant momenta, right? So if you look inside Q, which I think is still over here, I have the stress energy tensor, which is T. I'm going to talk about that in a second. And I have H, which is P squared. So if I come with P squared and I use this OPE, what I find is that P squared at Z times e to the k dot x at W is proportional to k squared e to the k dot x. There's a double pole and then some other stuff. So if I want to kill this double pole, because I want that property to be satisfied, I need k squared to be 0. So already this tells us that, and this condition tells you that there are only massless particles. Oops. So we're getting there because we want to describe the S matrix of massless particles in field theory. So now we just need to look a little bit more.
Can you say again why we don't want a double pole?
So it's the, so this condition here. So it's it's because you want that, well, it's a physical condition. It's because if you from BRST quantization, you want your states to be invariant under the gauge transformations, because they have to be gauge invariant. What your BRST operator does for you, it is implementing those gauge transformations, right? Because those constraints generate the gauge transformations, then requiring that the operator is annihilated by Q is really requiring that it is gauge invariant. And so it's just, you could do this by hand. It's just a trusting the Q, the, doing by BRST quantization. You don't have to worry too much about it. But the physics behind it is that you're really asking the states to be gauge invariant with respect to the gauge symmetries we had on the worksheet. That's all it's doing. Did it answer your question?
Why don't we say that the like first pole part is also 0?
Ah, OK. So that's the first bulk part is also going to be zero. So if you remember from string theory, I should just address it now. If I'm talking about a fixed vertex operator, so something that sits at a point, then a fixed vertex operator comes always with insertions of C and C tilde, because a fixed vertex operator is telling you that when I'm gauging the symmetries on the worksheet, I can gauge everywhere except at this point. So C, remember that C is like the is like a gauge parameter, right? It's just a gauge parameter, but with opposite statistics as a fermion. So by putting an insertion of C and C tilde at each point, I am telling the path integral, if you want, that I'm gauging by gauge symmetries, I'm quotienting by gauge symmetries that vanish at this point. So this is the same thing that you do in string theory. When you're talking about string theory, you want to gauge worksheet gravity. But if you have a sphere with a bunch of points, then I'm not free to use a gauge parameter that can vary on this point, because those points are not part of my surface. They are just marked points. They're points that I removed. So I have to gauge through diffeomorphisms that leave those points fixed, right? And the way to do that in the BRST framework is that you put insertions of these operators, because then your gauge your BRST symmetry vanishes at those points, and that's equivalent to the gauge symmetry vanishing at those points. It's a long story. Make a long story short. It just tells you that there's a grading by ghost number on your physical states. This grading tells me that I need a ghost number one and ghost number one for a fixed state. So I need to have those two insertions. Then I am free to add some function of p and dp. And then I have my dependence on x like this. So it's a feature of the formalism that your fixed vertex operators have to be of this form. And if you want to a better explanation, we can talk about later. So the point comes about that because our BRST operator already has a power of C, the C with the C gives a simple zero. So I get a simple zero. So the simple pole of this constraint doesn't really give me anything, because I have a simple zero and a simple pole, so that's just holomorphic. So that doesn't give me anything. Yeah, so I should say this is up to holomorphic terms, as we want to say. So it's really, I only have to kill the double pole and nothing more. Yes?
Why is the physical constraint that the OP is zero and not the commutator?
Oh, the OP is a commutator. So it's we can talk about that. But the OP gives you all the commutators in a radial quantization. Is the way to say. I can show you later, but that's it's a statement about CFTs. It's a statement about vertex operator algebras. The OP knows about all the commutators between those fields. So we had that constraint. We had another constraint, which is how t acts on the exponential. And this you can just see straight away that is just k dot x over z minus w. There's no more holomorphic terms here. There's only holomorphic terms here. So this tells me that e ik dot x has zero conformal weight, which is very different from string theory, because in string theory, this expression, even though x had no conformal weight, the exponential had conformal weight. And the conformal weight of the exponential is what allows you to put some functions here to balance that conformal weight, and then you can have an infinite number of operators that you can write down. But here, because this has no conformal weight, then there's only a finite number of things that I can write here, right? So this has conformal weight zero. So there is a conformal weight zero. These two guys together, they have a conformal weight which is it's just holomorphic on front weight minus 2. So I have to compensate by a function f. F of p dp must have conformal weight 2, because then if I then t if I write t with v is 0, and then from those two conditions tells me that this is a physical vertex operator. So physical vertex operator in this theory are of this form. And because this can have at most conformal weight 2, there's not many things. There's only a finite number of things that I can write here. So the spectrum is finite just because of that. And the spectrum is finite and is just given by massless particles. Running out of time. So now, you might ask exactly what is the spectrum for this theory. And the spectrum on the bosonic theory ends up that you can write down there is a scalar, there is a symmetric traceless two form, and there is an antisymmetric two form. And you might hope that those are actually the same fields as the NS and S sector of the string, so it's the Dilaton, gravity, and the B field. But it turns out that if you calculate amplitudes on that theory by itself, you don't get gravity amplitudes, unfortunately. It's a bit sick. So what you need to do is you need to add to get gravity or to get really gravity, you need to add another sector. And this sector is going to be a free fermion CFT. So it's going to be an action of fermions that is given by so this n psi mu d bar psi mu. So in particular, if I add two fermions, then now these fermions, they have conformal weight 1/2. And so it gives me more. So I add this. This is inside some action with the bosonic action I had before. So now by adding that, I get new constraints. Which are denoted g and g bar, which are psi dot p and psi 1 dot p, psi 2 dot p. And this generate a supersymmetric algebra in the sense that g is the same as g bar z g bar, which gives me p square. Right, so because of this, there are extra fermionic symmetries. There are extra fermionic symmetries that you can gauge, and you can go through the same process again, by adding bosonic ghosts, just like the RNS string, you have a larger BRST operator, and you find that physical. And you find that physical operators now are given, again, by the cohomology of the BRST operator. But this is now changed because you have more constraints. So now, because you have, at constraints, you have 1, 2, p, t, and p squared. They're all zero, and they're all inside a BST operator. Then a fixed vertex operator in this theory is given by an expression which you might have seen if you looked at the fermionic string, the RNS string, but it looks like this. Psi 1, psi 2, HDI, k dot x. Because these constraints, they don't give you anything. What these constraints give you as new is that you need these polarizations. So this constraint for Q of V to have only to have no poles, then is if only if k squared equals 0 and epsilon dot k is equal to 0. So here you see the appearance of polarizations which you didn't have before, and that's thanks to the fermions, because now I can write out vertex operators like this. This has conformal weight 1 in total. I haven't told you what these guys are, but these have conformal weight minus 1. But this is, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that this has conformal weight minus 1, this has conformal weight 0, and because the fermions have conformal weight 1/2 each, then this is basically the only thing you can write down that is Q closed. And you find that here you have something which is, you have a trace part which is going to give you the dilaton, you have a symmetric part that's going to give you the metric, and you have an antisymmetric part that gives you the B field. And when you calculate correlation function on the fermions, you get a Pfaffian. So which you probably haven't seen in the CFT. But it's just a fact that if you have bilinear on fermions on a CFT, so in this case, size and size, this always gives you a Pfaffian of some big matrix psi. And I haven't told you how, but this is the same Pfaffian that you get as in CHY. Right? So this is the difference between that and that theory is that it has a different integrand I. So they give you, they are really different theories. And the claim is that this theory with two fermions gives you the CHY formulas. But I haven't told you exactly how. Now, it's 1 hour is really a short time to go through all of that. What I want to just finish off, if I have 5 minutes, is just tell you very quickly how the scattering equations appear in this formalism, which is the interesting part. So if you recall how we had an action, I don't have enough time to give all the details of that, but it's all in the references I gave you. So if you look back, I had an action which was p dot dx, right? And I already set all my Lagrangian multipliers to 0. If I add a bunch of vertex operators, vi's, so inside those guys I have a bunch of e to the I ki's dot x at different points zi's. So because this is inside an exponential in the path integral, I can add this to the action as a source term, which is given by ki dotted x on z, and a delta function z minus zi, right? The delta function just fixes these guys to a particular point, and this acts as a source for the field. So I can take this, and because this is the only dependence on x that I have on my vertex operator, this is contained here, then I can take them into the action, and I can look at equations of motion for p, which are given by x because it's a first order action. That just gives me d bar p. So this equals to 0. Then is d bar p is equal to ki delta z minus zi. And the solution to that equation is given by P of z is equal to the sum over ki z minus zi. And this is the same P as in chy, right? So we're getting there. And so that's the same P as we have in CHY. And what we need, and we know that we are imposing a P squared equals zero. So to get P squared equals zero is actually a question of moduli. And I don't want to get, well, we'll see how much detail we can get. But the question is, the thing is that when you have a bunch of fixed vertex operators, as I was saying before, you're not free to do any kind of gauge transformations, because the fixed vertex operators come with insertions of C and C tilde. So whenever I do some kind of BRST transformation of a field, it is always going to be proportional to C or C tilde times some other polynomial on the fields on x and p's. Right? So this gauge transformations always vanishes at those points. So I'm not free to change the value of the gauge transformation on those points. So what does it mean in practice? In practice is that if I try to use a gauge fixing function, f of e, which was my Lagrange multiplier, should just be e, so that I can set e to 0, this is not allowed, because I'm not allowed to set e to 0 on top of these points, right? And if you recall that the variation of e is given by d bar of alpha, and by dimensional reasons, I have the dE is equal to 0. So e is a whole anti-holomorphic one forms with values on the tangent that is closed, and so holomorphic, and defined up to d bar of something else. So there is a cohomology, and so he actually lives in a cohomology, which is the space of e's up to this. So there is a space of e's up to this gauge transformation, right? So e has values on some cohomology. And actually, it has values on, if anyone is familiar with this, it's the notation for that is this. N, which is just saying that E is an anti-holomorphic one form with values on the tangent bundle with zeros at the marked points up to this gauge equivalency. So at the end of the day, that's a bunch of maths just saying that this is not allowed when there are punctures. So we can only vary E inside this cohomology class, which means that the only thing we can do is that we can pick a basis for this space. So you pick mu r's, and there are n minus 3 of this by topological reasons as basis. And what you can do is that you can pick, so now you can pick f of e to be a function e that you want to set to 0, but you can set to 0 up to cohomology, which means that I can set to 0 up to elements of that basis. So now this is leftover moduli that I have to integrate over. And then there is this basis. And this is just something that you can write very explicitly on a few examples for that. And this is a proper gauge fixing function that you can do. And I'm going to tell you that you see that there's only n minus 3 of them. So that's really, you see already that they are related to the scattering equations, because there are as many of them as there are scattering equations. So what you do is that you add to the action, as is usual, is q of e which is the usual term that you actually is the gauge fixing term to the action. It's a gauge fermion. Sometimes it's called the gauge fermion. And what you found, this is, it gives you the bosonic, the fermionic ghost action minus R times mu R P squared. That just comes from the BRST part of it, minus a sum over Q R the tilde. So these are the same moduli I have before, so there's an integration over them. And Q is given by Q of SR is just QR, which means that these guys are fermionic, because Q is a fermionic operator. And because I'm integrating, if in the path integral, I'm integrating over E, and I cannot set E completely to zero, it means that there is a leftover integral over these two guys. So I still need to integrate over Q and SR. And so if you look at the path integral, what I do have is I have integrals of this form. This dependence here is in the action, so this dependence is an exponential in tilde mu of R. So this is a fermionic integral, so it just brings down the linear term of this. So this gives you an insertion of an operator like this. And for the bosonic, it's very similar. But now, because this is a bosonic integral, it's not just not just a linear term, but it's actually a delta function, because this S has values from minus infinity to plus infinity. So this gives you a delta function, tilde u r. So inside, to calculate amplitudes, if I'm calculating amplitudes properly with fixed vertex operators, I have to add those extra insertions on my correlation function. And the job of those extra functions is now to generate the scattering equations, because they are coming from the gauge they're coming from this gauge fixing term, which is gauge fixing p squared to p zero. So what happens now is that I can pick, it's just a fact, and I'm going to just state it, that I can pick MR to extract residues at marked points. So what does it means is that then that insertion that I had, n minus 3 of delta n d square u r sigma n tilde u r, then this goes to something which is an n minus 3. There's a delta, which is just taking a residue around ZR of P squared, ZI of P squared of Z. And then I have an insertion of P here around ZI. So I have an insertion of n minus 3 of those guys as these guys come close to the vertex operators. The B gets rid of the C, and this you see already that what is the residue at Zi? The residue at Zi is what we already know from before. This, we have the same p as chy, so this is just ki dot kj over Zi minus Zj. And the delta function is setting this equals to zero, and these are the scattering equations. So scattering equations appear when you do the proper gauge fixing of this two-dimensional chiral theory, which is called the Ambitisser string. And sorry, that was a little bit fast, but it's a yes. So yeah, I haven't. You know, I'm running late, right? A little bit. So I'm gonna end here. So sorry, it was a little bit fast. But what I want you guys to take out, to take away from this, is that there is a CFT that you can promote to a string theory. It's a Cairo CFT. It's very different from the string theory. But you can use the same tools of string theory, like CFT techniques, BRST operators, things that you're going to see in more detail probably next week with Oliver. But you can do all these calculations, and you can look at the reference that I gave you before. And if you do the gauge fixing in a very in a proper way to do the gauge fixing, which is taking into account these extra moduli that appear when you have punctures, which is really the same story as string theory, even though you might not have seen it in this way, you find that you have extra insertions that you have to put on your correlation function, and those extra insertions really does give the scattering equation. So this theory does give the CAGY formulas, and it is a consistent string theory that gives us this the CAGY formulas, and I'm gonna leave like that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, so I guess it's maybe convenient to have Eduardo around all week, so
yes.
Maybe the bulk of the questions can be deferred to a later moment.
Please do come and ask questions.
Or is there an urgent one for right now? Okay, very good. So let's thank Eduardo again. Okay.